This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Peter Gordon from the Western Bulldogs. Good morning, Peter. How are you?
Good, Macca. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. We, Peter got waylaid by Betty on the way in for our resident Bulldogs maniac.
But Betty is the kind of radio station representative I like to see.
Oh, yeah. And one of our other key volunteers, actually, and you'll know the name, but your LGBTI supporter group.
Mm-hmm. Will Strzok, you may be gravitating towards.
Yeah. You know, and they're pretty passionate, the same as one of our other shows, Chicks Talking Footy. So it's great to have you here, and you know, I know how important Saturday mornings are. I'm here with Jane Garrett, the member for Brunswick, who's going to wrestle me for the microphones. But
who just read out a commercial? I mean, I know. Who'd have thought? Whole new career for you,
well,
Jane
Garrett.
Well,
I think Garrett. I did all right there.
A live reader's good. You might have to do one too, Peter. You never know. First off, both you and Jane have been in the US recently.
Yes.
And we wake up this morning that interesting group of people, Donald Trump, has sacked his current chief of staff and appointed a new chief of staff. He's got a new communications director, Mr. Scaramucci. As the leader of an organisation, you know, a large community-based football club, as well as a businessman, is there anything in management terms you can learn from the Donald?
No.
Nothing.
No. I mean, look, he's... what can you say about him? He's an ongoing comedy show, which is also a slow-motion train wreck for the world.
Isn't it?
In fact, these days it's not so slow-motion, is it? It's just... it's horrifying to watch. It's just horrifying to watch. And, you know, if there's one truism from my point of view about Trump, there's some truth in the... slogan, Make America Great Again, because if 60-odd million people cast their vote for Donald Trump, then America's in serious need of repair.
It is, isn't it? It is. And, you know, when you're in the States, and, you know, how do you find, you know, people talking to you? Whenever I'm in the States, everyone always opens a conversation usually by, oh, by the way, I didn't vote for Trump. I said, I want to meet someone that did. And I did in Las Vegas a limo driver who proceeded to tell me that, you know, she was a small businesswoman, da-da-da, and Trump's really good at business. I said, he's been bankrupt 5 times. Oh, yes, but within the law. I mean, it's a really, really strange thing. So when people engage you there, Jane or Peter, what do you find?
Well, I have a number of friends over there of long-standing who are Republicans, and I was pretty interested when I last went over there to talk to them about it, because he is, let's face it, indefensible, and they concede that. And there are clearly as deep rifts between Team Trump and the mainstream of the Republican movement as there are, you know, Trump and the rest of the world. And their view is we just need to ride this out and move on him. But they're also, you know, profoundly affected by the fact that 30-40% of the voting public still like him. And they think that there's really no point in moving on him or the mainstream Republican movement turning on him while he's still got that, what do they call it, his core, his base. So I don't know. I've had a number of arguments with some people, some friends of long standing, because to me, I can't understand how anyone cannot want to agitate against what's going on there.
Yeah.
It's interesting on that, because you do feel at some point in the near future there has to be the core, the pillars of America and the pillars of the Republican Party will have to grapple with this. I think this week has been a particularly, you know, appalling and bizarre. I mean, with the mooches New York Times spray and then the sacking of the chief now, and it's lurching from chaos to chaos. And I suppose the one thing you'd say, the Wall Streets, the business people in America, the need for certainty around government policy and approaches and to not have perpetual chaos, this level of instability and uncertainty on a day-to-day basis, you're lurching from, you know, one thing to the next. Do you feel, in your speaking to those people, I know they can't do anything yet, but it would be coming soon, or you're just there just sitting?
Jane, I think it's an unprecedented period in history. I don't think anyone can really predict what's going to happen. I've asked some of those people, who, none of whom defend him, and I haven't met many of those people. You meet some of them in the streets over there, and even in Australia, you see the odd Trump cap being worn by people. I choose not to engage with those with those people. But I've got to the stage of wondering, what would he need to do to have, you know, let's pick a name, the Andrew Bolts of the world, say, okay, that was crazy. Mm. What would he need to say, I'm taking every Mexican's firstborn child? What insane thing would he need to do next? He's already accused Barmer, you know, obviously, ridiculously, of tapping his phone.
Yeah.
He's suggested without a scintilla of evidence that 3 million people voted fraudulently. I mean, he makes these sweeping allegations, which are obviously lies. Very little accountability of what thing that was even more insane would he need to do?
To
get this core base of people who just love his extreme right wing nutty approach to things. What would he need to do to peel off some of those people and have them say, enough's enough, I can't support that?
I think what drives so many of those supporters is their absolute hatred of the Democrats, of Hillary, of Obama. And, you know, when we look at it from the prism that we live in, you think, well, how can they actually believe this shit? But they do.
Mm.
And, you know, Obamacare is a great example. You know, somewhere between 18 and 23 million Americans are going to lose health insurance that have never had it before.
Mm.
And they're all saying, yes, scrap Obamacare. And then you see articles are now appearing from time to time, you know, in the fake New York Times, as he called it, or the Amazon New York Times, as he calls it, where people are saying, well, I didn't actually realise this, what it meant. I voted for him. And they're not going to have health care.
It's weird to think of what it would be like if it was actually the Democrats,
yes,
who had these, you know, purported associations with Vladimir Putin and Russia,
yeah,
and the sort of that patriotic sort of core to the Republicans, you did what? You spoke to who?
Mm.
And yet somehow, because it's Trump, any man of collusion and his son taking sort of secret meetings with some Russian emissary, and then
son-in-law.
And then Jared Kushner giving three or four different explanations. Oh, I forgot about that one.
Oh, and 100 meetings.
Just imagine if it was transposed to the liberal side of politics.
I know.
Over there, what would happen? It's a weird thing.
Now, we've got a couple of things here. It says, people want to talk about dual citizenship, Julia Banks, member for Chisholm. Why are people so afraid of their allegiances to Australia and our political class? That's a good one. One here about the banned state MP, and you can touch on that, Jane. Do we want grumpy men like you in the inner city, Macca? Well,
that's a fair point. I think
the vibe of the city is lost with corporate wankers, in my opinion. Oh, there we go. Oh, no, here's one. I work for Mercedes-Benz, someone's asked here, do you think your new partnership with Mercedes-Benz Vans is a good association, and when do they come on board?
They come on board next year,
mm-hmm.
And of course I'm glad that you specified it's Mercedes-Benz Vans.
Yes.
Because there's an elite section of Mercedes-Benz.
Which is the van division.
Vans, and I imagine you'd be going with the kind of sports cars and the AMG range.
Well, yeah. You're on the money there.
But with the Bulldogs, there's this theme. It's the pickup truck.
You'd be pretty excited by the Ute.
It's embodied in Bevo, really.
Yeah.
You can imagine him with the Mercedes-Benz pickup, you know, the tools of trade in the back, driving around, because that's the soul of the Western Bulldogs Footy Club, Macca. I mean, there are other clubs, let's face it, that wouldn't be consonant with that sort of industrial base. Carlton Footy Club, for example, which I know is has a special place in Jane Garrett's heart.
Hey, there's plenty of tradies who go for the Blues, thank you.
Although she looks like she backs for Collingwood by the look of her top.
I'm in my Nike gear.
It's a sore point, I know, because Carlton has traditionally been the club of the Liberal Party and going way back.
You know, see what I have to put up with here.
People like Robert Menzies.
Yes, he used to park his Bentley on the outer.
Exactly, yeah. It could just as easily be a Mercedes-Benz sports car. Malcolm Fraser, of course.
So we're going to go on with this, are we?
And the modern iteration, of course, Jane herself.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Quintessential. Toffee Liberal person.
So it starts next year, and it's the first football club sponsorship Mercedes-Benz and Vans has entered into.
No, we're thrilled to have them, and they've been a terrific partner, and looking forward to what we can do. There's a long line of requests from the players to get involved in the sponsorship. Marcus Bontempelli sees himself driving one. JJ's put his hand up for one. And I think it's fair to say in the last dozen contract negotiations with players, the term Mercedes-Benz Vans has been raised. So it's a popular offering.
Makes me feel good. Jane, one of your colleagues was refused entry to the US, travelling in a group of parliamentarians, and I can't name them all. I know Fiona Patten was one of them. And so it was refused entry because, I gather, he'd visited Syria.
Yeah, look, so it's Khalil Eady, who's the deputy president in the Legislative Council. He's the member for Western Metro in the upper house. And yes, he. I understand just from the reports. I haven't spoken to him myself, but he's been a long-standing MP since 2006, I believe. And certainly, the government is asking very serious questions of authorities as to how that occurred. And no doubt, we'll be getting more information. But it's been very distressing for the other committee members. Certainly, Fiona Patten was on there. Natalie Suleiman, who's a Labor member in the lower house. She was there too, and she's been very distressed. He's of Muslim faith, so I think it's been a very difficult time. Again, having come back just recently from the US, I know that going through customs, etc., is pretty grueling exercise, and I understand why, given what's happened to that country, why they have very strict requirements. No one can begrudge them that. But again, with Trump and the new regime, perhaps we have to have a look at whether it's going a bit far.
Can I add something to this? From my point of view, I think Australian citizenship is a sufficient condition. I think that I'm not at all troubled by the fact that many of these, but whatever their political background, may have a dual nationality. I mean, we've all come from somewhere.
Yeah.
And it makes up for Australia's rich mix. I'm not at all troubled that someone may have an Italian dual citizenship, or English, or American.
I've got Irish as well.
Or whatever. We voted for them understanding that they came from somewhere.
Yeah.
And if they're Australian citizens, that ought to be enough. I'd like to see some constitutional reform to reflect 21st century Australia in that way.
I agree. I think there was a great pity, we're just going to go to a break, but Bernie Finn wasn't on that trip. I would have loved to have seen him led off by the immigration officials. But Bernie would have...
He would have sailed through.
Yeah, no, he would have been some socialist plot. We're all pretty passionate about social justice. We all have particular areas that we're interested in. Peter, you're a bit of an old campaigner on these issues, on social justice. Why? What drives you?
Oh, I guess I grew up in West Footscray and started with my friend Rob Starry, the Western Suburbs Legal Service, in about 1978. We were the only two law students from the Western Suburbs of Melbourne that we knew.
Wow.
And all of the trendy kids, you know, the John Faynes of the world, were volunteering at Fitzroy Legal Service. It was the cool thing to do. We actually thought there's more of a need for a legal service in the West. And so we got involved in that and started seeing, you know, what the legal needs of the poor as we put it in those days, really were. And we gravitated pretty quickly into environmental litigation. There's a whole lot of toxic industry over there, and some of the licensed and unlicensed discharges near people's homes were shocking to us. So it was a great cause, and it was a sort of great camaraderie and teamwork that we got out of the whole thing. It was also a great learning for the career I ultimately had, fighting sort of asbestos companies and those sort of things. But it was also, in terms of legal education, it was a bit of a go for free, in the sense you could turn up to planning applications and the companies would have their QCs, and their big Collins Street law firms, and we had us.
Yep.
So, but for us, people weren't going to get represented at all. So, you know, we took a swing. And I remember my third or fourth time in, I was against a very eminent QC called Jack Barnard, who was sort of a doyen of the Melbourne Bar. And we had this argument, and I won. I think it was only a minor thing. Like, I wanted a cost argument or something like that. But I remember it sort of bouncing out of court, saying, so much for him. But it was a great grounding. And it was only by accident that back in those days, before the days of the internet or whatever, you got to the end of your law degree, you used to have to write out, if you were a kid like me, handwrite your applications to law firms. And I started in the Yellow Pages. Remember the Yellow Pages?
I do.
Spent a day doing that, got down to about, P, Q or R, and then just sort of fell asleep from exhaustion. And my dad, who'd been watching me, felt sorry for me. So he sort of took my standard text and he went to S. And in S was Slater and Gordon. So they were the only law firm to offer me a job. And it was because my dad had written my application after I'd gone to bed.
So all the ones you wrote were ratchet, they didn't work.
They're all the same, but I think I only appealed to that firm. And in that firm in those days... had a great socialist tradition. It had been founded by Ted Hill and Jim Hill, who were active members of the Communist Party in Australia in the 50s, and very involved with the industrial movement. And the sort of moral leadership of the firm in those days had been passed over to Jeff Jones and Mike Higgins. And I was Mike's article clerk. He's one of the legends of Slater and Gordon, and he was fighting the first battles against James Hardy at the time. So, looking back, it was an enormous privilege to work with him, and did that for a number of years, and fought a number of battles. When he first tried to get access to James Hardy's written documents as to what they knew about the dangers of asbestos, when they knew it and what dangers they were subjecting their workers to, they actually brought an application in court to say, we don't want to give these documents to Slater and Gordon or Mike Higgins because he's a dangerous socialist and can't be trusted with them. And he turned up to the court, sniffing with indignation that he was an officer of the court, and how dare they make this application. And the court found in his favour and handed over the documents, which 2 weeks later coincidentally found themselves in the middle pages of Vanguard newspaper, which I think was just a coincidence, I'm sure.
Of course.
Wouldn't have handed them over.
So your, the club is an abiding passion for you, and I know it takes a lot of your time, but... You're actually not making a return, but perhaps revisiting law. You're going to start up a new firm, I believe.
I guess I've had two professional passions in my life. I first got involved in the Bulldogs in 1989 when the VFL, tried to destroy the club by merging it with Fitzroy, calling it the Fitzroy Bulldogs and moving it off to
Was that
Prince
Jungle
Park.
Jack Hamilton?
No, it was principally Ross Oakley.
Ross.
But the guy, the sort of intellectual wherewithal behind it, it was Ross, and it was Graeme Samuel and those two principally. So I had no football background. My career as a footballer was struck down at a very early age by a tragic lack of ability. But I did see it, as did many of us, as an assault on the suburb. There wasn't a lot going for the western suburbs of Melbourne at that time, but Footscray was a thing that we could all sort of rally around on the weekends and enjoy its successes. And so that was more of a social challenge than a football thing. I was never really a football person in the traditional sense, but I ran that campaign like a legal case, really, and prosecuted it for 3 weeks. And I was actually in negotiations with a few people, Rob Fordham, who was Deputy Premier to John Cain back in those days. I was in negotiations with him to become president, when I had a meeting with John Cain and David White, I think the health minister as it then was, because I was trying to get the TAC sponsorship back as the last thing, and John Cain said to me, "We're prepared to reinstate this this sponsorship, but the condition is we want you to be president." And that was the first time it had occurred to me that I'd have anything more than sort of a 3-week saviour role in the campaign. And I was pretty impressed by that.
Yeah.
"Tell me, Mr. Premier, why is it that you want me to be?" And he said, "I'll tell you why, because I think this is going to go broke again in 2 or 3 years, and we want someone to blame, and it's going to be you."
It's going to be you.
So that was my introduction to the...
any other reason?
To the job. Apparently not. So that was, in fact, the very same week I became president of Footscray, I became a partner at Slater and Gordon. And so I've had those two sort of passions in my career. I left Slater and Gordon in 2009 without intending to practice law again. But I happened to meet a guy who became a friend who was a thalidomide survivor.
Yep.
So he had two foreshortened arms as a consequence of his mum taking that drug. And it led me down a path of studying that and realising that they'd got the medicine wrong and that they'd excluded from compensation and recognition upwards, I think, of 2/3 of the thalidomide epidemic around the world. And so I really wanted to do that case. And I'd had enough of sort of... I was proud of my association with Slater and Gordon. It had been 30 years and it had been enough. So I started Gordon Legal with my wife Kerry and my eldest son Patrick, and we happily went along just doing that one case, which he did for 3 or 4 years, and settled it in 2014 in total for just over $100 million, which was a terrific result. And we changed the medicine, which I was most proud of, and helped a few lawyers around the world with that sort of thing. And then since then, I've sort of kept it open. I've really been more involved running the Bulldogs in the last 4 or 5 years, but doing little bits of things that had attracted me. I was asked by the union movement, I guess most notably, to ask Dyson Hayden to recuse himself from the Trade Union Royal Commission for perceived bias. I think we actually included actual bias as well in the end. Dyson Hayden found in his own favour.
I'm not biased.
In that particular application. But it was fun, and it was nice to reconnect with the union movement in the way that I did. And so, I just feel that now's a good time to get back into it. And so, I'm revamping Gordon Legal as an offering for in the traditions of Slater's when I first started it, I guess, acting for working people and unions and against toxic industries. And that's where I see the next 10 years, Megan.
Well, there's a great to hear it, because we need law firms that believe in what they're doing and the advocacy that they're doing. There's another firm you're probably aware of, Right Side Legal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they bat really hard for those people that are up against it. So I'm glad to see it. It's a good thing.
Right Side is Michael Magazanik's.
That's right.
Michael worked with me on the thalidomide case.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Came
he's
in after guy. 18 months and helped out in a really important way.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.